I'm going to give you another reason to celebrate Hanukkah this year, and hopefully a new layer of depth to your understanding of what this holiday is all about, and something that's a little more modern and interesting, its close proximity to Christmas, which we always kind of view as a just a coincidence, which I guess it is, but it's also popularized. Hanukkah. Does anybody else know the other parallel Jewish holiday, which is very similar to Hanukkah? It has the same exact status, because Hanukkah is a post-biblical holiday, right? It's not in the five books of Moses, right? It's not Passover commemorating the Exodus. It's not Shavuot commemorating the giving of the Torah. It's not Sukkot. We go out and sit in the booths, right? This is a post-biblical, rabbinically instituted holiday. And there's one more post-biblical, rabbinically instituted holiday. Purim, thank you very much. What's your name?
Shana.
Okay, and which is more popular in America today? Right, I'm sure most of us grew up doing some Hanukkah, but I would imagine many of us didn't grow up doing much Purim. And that's actually very common in the American Jewish scene, where you got a lot of Hanukkah Jews, but not a lot of Purim Jews. Which doesn't make sense if you think about how much fun Purim is also. It's kind of like the Jewish Halloween. But we're going to come back to that. The reason for that is just purely sociological. Hanukkah became like the Jewish Christmas, if you will. When kids, and everyone's having such a fun time lighting their Hanukkah trees or bushes, whatever it is, and everybody's going crazy with the lights, you want to give your Jewish kids something, so they don't feel like a loser.
Why Adam Sandler came up with Hanukkah.
That's why Adam Sandler came up with Hanukkah. But I'm going to go back to this. We're going to read something at the end of class tonight. But first I want to go through the story. And this is not the story that you studied in Hebrew. How many of you guys went to Hebrew school growing up? Okay. How many of you guys hated Hebrew school growing up? Okay. So I want to take you back in Jewish history and give you the uncensored version of the Hanukkah story. Yeah, it's a little racy. It's a little, it's not what you were taught. It's not what I was taught either. And that's actually going to be my main question tonight. When did the Hanukkah story actually take place? So I'm going to give you a little bookmark in Jewish history so you can understand. Everybody here knows about how we started as a nation. We started how? As a people, as a nation, we were where?
Moses
brought us out of Egypt. We started as an enslaved people in Egypt. Moses brought us out of Egypt, and eventually, after wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, we make it to Israel. It took us a while to get settled there and to finally do what we were supposed to do, but the purpose of going to Israel was to establish a temple and to be this light amongst the nations, living in Jerusalem around the temple. If you go to Israel today, you go to Jerusalem, that's what everybody congregates. It's the most important historical ancient site in Israel, is the last remaining wall from the ancient temple. Now that first temple was built by Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, and it stood for about 400 years until a great empire, a world empire, superpower, I guess we would call them today, destroy that first temple, and they were the, and don't worry, you're not being tested, but I'm giving you a little overview on Jewish history. Say again?
Greeks.
Soon. Not yet. We're not up to the Greeks yet. Not yet. Who destroyed the first temple? That was the Babylonians. 586 BCE. Nebuchadnezzar was his name. It was a terrible moment in Jewish history, and really should have spelled the end of Jewish history, because there were tens of thousands of Jews that were killed. Survivors fled to Babylonia, modern-day Iraq area. But we came back. And we rebuilt our second temple 70 years after the first one was destroyed by the Babylonians. Okay, you guys with me so far?
Yes.
I know it was a long day. It's a little warm in the room. It's raining out. You're like, I'm eating pizza, but I'm focused. I'm with you. Okay, good. So we got the temple back. That was under the more tolerant Persian Empire that we the Jews of Great Neck, that we were able to finally rebuild a temple. Who toppled the Babylonian Empire? If anybody remembers your world history, it was basically superpowers in the world. Usually one superpower. In more modern times, the United States, the former Soviet Union, or France and England, you had superpowers sharing it. But in those days, in antiquity, it was basically one superpower. So it was the Babylonians, and then the Persians toppled the Babylonian Empire. And under the more tolerant Persian Empire, they permitted Jews to go back to Israel. Now that story, remember we talked about Purim? That was the Purim story. The Purim story happened before the Hanukkah story. We're not up to Hanukkah yet. We're getting very close though. The Jews come back to Israel, which is being controlled by the great Persian Empire. And the Persians, of course, are then destroyed by the Greeks under Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was a very charismatic military leader. He was also a philosopher. Had a good relationship with the Jewish community, actually. A lot of Jews to this day are named Alex, because there was a moment in history where many Jews named their children after Alexander the Great, because of he treated the Jews very, very well. But when he was killed in battle, his empire, the Greek Empire, was basically divided into three parts. And the one part that's relevant for the Hanukkah story is the Greek Seleucid Empire. You say that with me? The Greek Seleucid Empire under Antiochus, who is the bad dude, the villain, the tyrant in the Hanukkah story. And this one-third, if you will, of Alexander the Great, and this is about 150 years after Alexander the Great has conquered the ancient Near East. He's no longer alive. This is over a century and a half later. Do the Jews find themselves governed by the Greek Seleucid Empire? And the Syrian prince, his name was Antiochus, was the Greek ruler stationed over Jerusalem, where the majority of the Jewish people were living at the time. The Second Temple is still standing. Remember, the Jews built the Second Temple 70 years after the Babylonians destroyed the first one. The Second Temple stood for about 10 years longer than the First Temple. First Temple stood, Solomon's, for 410 years. The Second for 420 years. About 200 years into the Second Temple era, you've got the Hanukkah story. What happened? What was going on? Antiochus was very ambitious, and he was not simply interested in military conquest, but he was also interested in expanding Greek culture and religion throughout his territory. And I say religion because when I refer now to Greek culture, I'm not talking about Aristotle and Plato and all the classics we studied in college. I'm talking about what was then called Hellenism. And these were the opposing ideological forces to which the Jewish people, our ancestors, living in ancient Judea, under the Greek Seleucid Empire, were subject. Hellenism. Hellenism very much believed in the physical. You familiar from college? Remember if you've studied any of the great, not Greek classics, it's more philosophy, but the Greek mythology of Zeus and Hercules and these perfect physiques, right? These statues you'll see to this day in some of the great museums of the world. And they very much believed in worshiping the physical. And they denied anything that was spiritual, that was beyond the physical that you could experience with any of your senses. And this was not a small ideology. Hellenism was sweeping the ancient Near East. It was literally in the rage. And people were just starting to abandon their own philosophies, their own ethnicities, to become part of the big Greek culture of Hellenism. And Jews were no different. And there were some Jews that were very interested in becoming more Greek than Jewish.
Rabbi? Is it like Hellenism, is that from like Helen of Troy?
I don't know.
That would launch 1,000 ships.
It's a great movie.
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Okay, it probably has something.
It's probably connected somehow.
Yeah,
it probably does.
Where are the chances?
Yeah, but it refers specifically to an almost a celebration of the physical world. Mm-hmm. You know, the Greeks are always known for the aesthetics. Even in Jewish tradition, we have a verse in the Torah already that Noah, who had 3 sons, Shem, Cham, and Yafet, Yefet, which means beauty, was supposed to have descended into the Greek civilization. And just the idea of appreciating art and aesthetics, and really almost an obsession, if you will, with the physical. Now, Antiochus was trying very hard to lure the people that lived within his empire into Hellenism and to get people to become good Greeks. And there was a Jew, his name actually, I don't even know what his original Jewish name, what was the most important Jewish leader in the community in those days? Anybody know? In the temple. Who was the leader in the temple? Who was he? Yeah. Not a person, but a... What's that? Well, he comes later. He comes later. But in the temple, who's the highest position? Right, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. The high priest, okay, his name was Shimon HaTzadik. And after him became Chonyo. And these were the rightful Kohen Gadols that were passed down from generation to generation. Chonyo, who was the rightful high priest, very holy man, had a brother who became Hellenized. And this was happening. Jews began to abandon their Jewish faith in favor of Hellenism. He changed his name to Jason. And he offered Antiochus a huge bribe to depose his own brother as the high priest and to appoint him instead. Antiochus wanted to do this because the way in to completely corrupt Judaism and replace it with Hellenism would be to take over the priesthood. And here he had this opportunity. And he got bribed by Jason to depose Chonyo and to appoint him as high priest instead. And Jason promised the king more money if he would authorize the building of a gymnasium for the youth of Jerusalem. Now these gymnasiums, if you're familiar with a little Greek history, were not just where you go to the gym, work out a little, pump some iron, shoot a couple of hoops. These gymnasiums are actually where the Olympics began, which we have such wonderful and positive associations with. But they would begin the games by offering sacrifices to their Greek gods. The games are also played in the nude. Because again, it was a celebration of the human body. And you can imagine how antithetical this all is to Jewish tradition. And the king agreed to building this gymnasium close to the Jewish temple, cultivating the practices of the Greek pagan customs and values to such an extent that they began luring the young Kohanim, the young priests, the young Jewish priests, away from the Jewish temple service to these gymnasiums. Because this is what the rage was. This is what was going on. And they began neglecting their Jewish service in favor of becoming Greek. If you want to know where I'm getting this information from, it's not written anywhere in the Torah. It's not written anywhere in the Talmud. These are secular history books. One was written by Josephus, who was a very controversial personality himself, but a great historian, Josephus Flavius. There's also a book that never made it into the Torah called the Book of Maccabees 1 and the Book of Maccabees 2. They're considered apocryphal literature, but historically significant. That's where I got my information. And Josephus talks about how the exercises that were performed in these gymnasiums were performed in the nude. And he says that they were Jewish boys who took pains to disguise their circumcisions. They didn't want to be seen as Jewish. So they kind of covered it up in a kind of strange manner. And sacrifices were offered up to Hercules and to other Greek gods. And little by little, Hellenism started spreading and Judaism started dying. And it got to a point where 171 BCE, Jason is removed from office by Antiochus, replaces him by a guy by the name of Millenius, who was a bigger crook and a worse of a self-hating Jew. I mean, nobody gets named Millenius in the Jewish community. He became a Hellenized Jew again. And Jason, Millenius was an emissary of Jason, and he used his position to undermine Jason. And they were kind of like fighting over each other, who could be a better Greek. And in order to pay off the huge debt that was owed to Millenius and his brother Lysimachus, who acted as deputy, they took the gold vessels from the temple to raise the money that they needed to pay off Antiochus. And when Chonio, remember Chonio, the rightful high priest, when he protested, they had him murdered. And they completely corrupted the priesthood, the kahuna. I told you, you never heard this stuff. Okay, this is not what they taught you in Hebrew school. This is what was going on in the Jewish community. Because Hanukkah didn't start with the Greeks coming along and saying, don't worship, you know, you can't keep your religion. This is how it started. Started by finding its way, seeping into the Jewish community, Jews on their own, abdicating their Judaism in favor of Hellenism, and trying to pull others in, and trying to curry favor with the Greek authorities. And hang on 1 second. I have a lot of crazy notes here. Hang on 1 second. All right, I don't want to keep you too much with. This continued to develop, and it got to a point where the Greeks entered the temple, pillaged the vessels, some of which were being sold off already to pay off Antiochus, forcibly reinstates this Hellenized Jew as the new high priest. Antiochus was not satisfied with that. He was loyal enough. And in 167 BC, he dispatched his general Apollonius with an army of 22,000 soldiers to Jerusalem. And battles start taking place. And a war begins. The Syrians breach the temple walls. The Syrians, I'm referring to the Syrian Greek Seleucid Empire, breached the temple walls in 13 places. They forbid the Jews to repair the breaches, and they begin constructing Greek altars throughout ancient Judea. And a decree was issued that required Jews to offer pigs, specifically in sacrifices, even in their own Jewish temple in Jerusalem. They banned circumcision, the Jewish festivals, Rosh Chodesh, Shabbat, Jewish dietary laws, ritual purity laws. Even to say that you were a Jew was publicly punished upon death. To declare that one was a Jew, to practice anything. And it just became a terrible, terrible thing. And this went on for quite a while. And the temple was converted into a place of prostitution and harlotry. Because when we talk about idol worship, we have to get a little involved with the culture. There was a lot of sexual immorality that was practiced alongside much of the idol worship in that time. And our temple was turned into basically a pagan temple. An idol was erected on the altar, and beginning on the 25th of the Hebrew month of Kislev, there were pigs now being offered upon the altar to a pagan deity in the Jewish temple. Now, most of the Jews complied. These were the Greeks. They were the world's empire. They were like the powerful Greek legions. But there were some Jews that actually refused to abdicate their Judaism, and they suffered martyrdom. And they were Jews that were publicly killed by the Greeks. And when I say the Greeks, I'm talking about Greek people and Jewish people who had become Hellenized Greeks. And this all continued. And there were all these crazy stories of martyrdom over the next years. People giving up their lives, and rather than succumbing to Millenius and to Antiochus, others gave in, though, out of despair. and some out of eventual conviction. And this is what was happening. And virtually every part of Judea was bombarded by Hellenism. Altars to Zeus and these pagan deities were created in every village, and they were forced to participate in these pagan rituals. And this all continued unabated until one man decided to change it. Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Matityahu was an elderly man at the time. He was the son of Yochanan, who was formerly the high priest. He left Jerusalem to settle in Modian, which was a Judean village near Jerusalem. He publicly refused to sacrifice to the idol that was set up in that town. And he publicly slew a man who was about to slaughter a pig to a Greek idol. And he proclaimed, "Whoever is zealous for the Torah, steadfast for the covenant, let him follow me." And Matityahu began what became one of the most famous rebellions or revolts against the Greek Empire. He had five sons, and they took their father and fled to the mountains in the Judean desert. And there were other loyal Jews that followed and joined him in the mountains, where they could practice their Torah, they could continue to observe as Jews, and they would begin a revolt against the Greek forces. The king Antiochus had to deal with his challenge to the authority, began to look for Jews hiding out in the Judean hills. Some people believe that the reason why we play dreidel to this day is that there were Jews who were, you know, privately studying Torah. When the Greeks would burst in, they would have these, like, I don't know, like tops that they would play around with, like they were gambling or just having, you know, fun. That's the legend why we play the dreidel to this day. And the revolt had begun. And by the time that Matityahu died in the year 165 BCE, the war against the Syrian Greeks was in full force. And he had five sons: Shimon, Yehuda, is the famous Judah, the Maccabee. They referred to as the Maccabeim, but they were from the Hasmonite family, the Hashmonaim. Yochanan Hashmonai. And Shimon, Yehuda, Elazar, Yochanan, and Yonatan. And the father, before he died, told him to follow the advice of Shimon. He was considered the wisest of the five sons, but to look to Judah the Maccabee to be their leader in battle. He was considered the greatest military strategist. Apollonius, Greek general, gathered soldiers to attack Judah, but Judah was forewarned. He struck first, killing Apollonius and much of his armies, taking their arms. Siron, commander of another Syrian Seleucid army, hears about this and figures he can make a great name for himself by squashing the Jewish revolt. He gathers a well-equipped army and he marches into Judea. And it was Judah's raw valor that rallied the Jewish forces, strengthening them for the long battle ahead. Philip and Apollonius, two main generals of Antiochus, tried to destroy the Hashmonaic forces, but instead suffered serious setbacks in places called Nablus and Beit Horon. I'm giving you all these specifics. You're not going to be tested. I'm not trying to impress you. I just want you to know this is like real stuff. This is like a real incident. Antiochus sent a third general, Siron, with a larger army, also defeated by Yehuda. Yehuda killed 800 of Siron's forces. This enraged Antiochus, who swore to crush the Jewish rebellion. His treasury now was depleted. He was known for very lavish personal spending, campaigns of conquest, having to pay a tribute to Rome. And he then invaded Persia to collect what he thought was money owed to him. He got bogged down in Persia. So they had to hand over the reins of the Greek battle against the Jews to Lycia. Lycia, in turn, appointed Ptolemy, silent P, Nicanor, and Gorgias, three of Syria's best generals, to lead the Judean campaign. And listen, we're talking real numbers. 40,000 army, foot soldiers, 7,000 cavalry. Right, they marched into Judea, and they were so confident that they would win that one of those three generals, Nicanor, summoned Gentile slave dealers from the coastal cities and promised them Jewish slaves at unprecedented low prices. He says, we're going to wipe them out, and we're going to have all these Jewish slaves. And this is what was going on. And there was one very important battle. Syrian army encamped near the town of Imaos, which is interesting because it's near Latrun. And if anybody knows the history of 1948 and 1967, we gained independence in 1948, but we couldn't hold on to Latrun. Ben-Gurion and his forces were unable, but we took it from 67. And it's interesting that this is over 2,000 years earlier, was where this battle was taking place. Yehuda gathered his forces at Mitzpah, biblical site of the prophet Samuel, just 12 miles from Imaos, which is where Latrun is today. And with extraordinary courage and some military deception, Yehuda outmaneuvered the far larger and better equipped Syrian Greek army. He split up his own forces, placing each battalion under the leadership of one of his brothers, forced the Syrian forces to divide, and then destroyed its smaller components, killing thousands and forcing the survivors to flee north to Syria. And that was essentially the last of any large Syrian force to occupy Judea. And the revolt was so successful that it swept Greek forces from Israel once and for all. And the Jewish people became the only minority and ethnicity of one of the colonies of ancient Greece that was successful in repelling the far larger and superior Greek forces from its colony, from its occupation. And what was the first thing that the Jewish forces, upon succeeding against the larger Greek army, did? Once they kicked them out, they had big parties, they started drinking, getting smashed. What did they do? And this might be the part of the story that you did learn in Hebrew school. What's the first thing they did?
They got lit.
What's that?
They got lit.
Keep going, good.
More specifically.
Yeah. Good. They walked into the temple. They found the temple completely defiled. It had been turned into a pagan, it was just awful. But what do you have to do every day in the temple? Something has to be lit every day, and that was the menorah. So they're searching around for the kind of oil that they could use to light the menorah. And all they could find was, come on guys, you know this part of the story. They could find one cruse of oil. And somehow that one cruse of oil miraculously lasted for 8 days. Which gave them enough time to obtain fresh supplies of oil. They can continue to perform the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. So I have a question for you. I just gave you a lot of information. And how many of you, just by show of hands, were aware of those battles? You were? Okay, I wasn't. And I went to not just Hebrew school, I went to like yeshiva my whole life, since I was like 5. I've been studying Talmud since I'm 7. And I'm going to read to you on your handout what the Talmud says about the holiday. But I will tell you, it wasn't until I started doing research for this class that I started learning about all these details. And I always wondered, and that's really my question, why is it that we don't know much about these stories about the incredible conquest? I mean, it would really be something we brag about, we'd be like really proud of. We're always getting our butts kicked in one country or another. It's nice once in a while, you know, when you read about how Jews fought back and were successful. And yet, take a look at the Talmud. It's the only thing that the entire Talmud, our oral tradition, says about Hanukkah. Take a look. What is the reason for Hanukkah? It's in Talmud 21b. For our rabbis taught, on the 25th of Kislev, that's the Hebrew month we're in, commence the days of Hanukkah, which are 8, on which a lamentation of the dead and fasting are forbidden. Right. You're not allowed to, if God forbid somebody dies during the days of Hanukkah, you have a funeral, you have a burial, but you don't give a whole eulogy. You're supposed to tone down the sadness a little, because it's Hanukkah. And you're not allowed to fast. Some people would fast if they have a bad dream, maybe you're fasting for some other reason. You're not allowed to fast during Hanukkah. That's what the Talmud says. Why? Because when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils, and when the Hashmonaim dynasty prevailed against and defeated them, they made search, and they found only one cruse of oil which lay with the seal of the high priest, but which contained sufficient for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle happened, and they lit the lamp, and it lasted for 8 days. The following year, these days were appointed a festival, and we say special prayer called Hallel, and we have Thanksgiving Day. It's a Jewish Thanksgiving, and we light the menorah. That's it. That's the only thing that our rabbinic literature says about the holiday. After everything I just shared with you, and I'm going to pose this question to you. Why do you think we have to go to secular sources, secular historical sources, to find out about these battles? Wouldn't they be things that... And I'll ask you another question. So maybe, you know, why wouldn't your Hebrew teachers or my rabbis share these miraculous victories of this tiny minority living, you know, colonized by the great ancient Greek Empire? I mean, shouldn't we be proud? Shouldn't we talk about our victories? Why don't we know about this stuff? How come nobody talks about it? Why the rabbis were so, they really skimped here. They didn't really mention much about the war, the battle. All it talks about is, it says, yeah, when we defeated them, we went into the temple and we found one cruse of oil and it lasted. Great. That's the only, ask a typical Jew, what are we celebrating? One cruse of oil lasted for 8. Let's see. Let's have some latkes. You know, like, so what's the deal? What do you think, guys? Yeah. Okay, I mean, you're right. It didn't happen in biblical times. It happened over 2,000 years ago, but it still was post-biblical times. It's true. And therefore...
Relevant to Judaism.
I mean, everything's relevant to Judaism, even things that happened yesterday. But keep going. What else? What else do you think? Why do you think if you were a great sage and you were writing the Talmud and you wanted to leave information that you thought was important for your descendants to learn, why wouldn't you include this information so we could teach our children, you know, when people come after us, defend yourselves and look at your ancestors. They kicked some Greek butt here.
Were they embarrassed?
Who was embarrassed?
About how?
I don't know. Why would you be embarrassed? I mean, we were the victims. We were oppressed and we defended ourselves. What's to be embarrassed about?
Well, it was a journey to get to standing up for ourselves to become victorious.
Sure. So let's learn about the journey.
Yeah.
I'm just making the question harder. Maya, you had a suggestion?
Maybe because the battle, you can't see like God directly in
it. Ooh, okay, that's one classic answer which is offered. You must work for the Manhattan Jewish Experience. So that's one answer, which is that, you know, a battle is never... You can always say Judah the Maccabee was a great military strategist, and he was a... You can always kind of write off God, even people who fought in the Six-Day War, which so many people have told me they thought it was completely miraculous. Other people said, well, Israel had great intelligence. I just watched, it was on Netflix, The Spy. Right? So, I mean, Eli Cohn provided such incredible intelligence that was very helpful, for the Israelis in the Six-Day War. So you could say, oh, we were in the right place at the right time. We knew what we were doing, Israeli bravado. Got all the hair in their chest, you know. They got a lot of chutzpah. You know, you can write off God, but you can't write off God if you have one cruse of oil. It's only got enough for one day and it lasts for 8. That's called a miracle. Mm-hmm. Now, this is me speaking. I don't love that answer because I'm like, how could you not consider this miraculous? Yeah?
We're religious people. We don't want to take all this joy and all the death that had to happen.
Okay, so a lot of people like to say that too. We're like spiritual beings. We don't glorify war. We fight if we have to, but it's not something we're going to pour a lot of, waste a lot of ink over in our religious books like the Talmud. We're going to talk about light and a menorah. And we'll mention the fact that we defeated them, but we're not going to get into the details.
Well, and also wasn't... Sorry.
Yeah?
Wasn't the Talmud written a lot? And a lot of the discussion of the Talmud started when Jews were living in diaspora, so you don't want to these books were public, so somebody else could read them.
Yeah, so some people suggest also, very good, because the Talmud was written after the Hanukkah story, during the Roman period, because who toppled the Greek Empire? The Romans. And there were things that were censored by rabbis in the Talmud so that the Romans wouldn't start thinking we would rebel against them like we did against the Greeks. So that could actually be a very legit possibility as to why the Talmud contains such little information. You know, other people are reading our stuff, and we unfortunately, after the Hanukkah story was over, by the way, we regained Israeli independence, Jewish independence, for 200 years until who came along? The Romans, and destroyed our second temple. Okay, that, but we're not focusing on the negative. Hanukkah's really happy. For the next 200 years, we had it really good. Let's eat those latkes. We'll deal with the destruction of the temple in the summer when we talk about Tisha B'Av. But that could very well be a reason. Very, very well be a reason. Michael.
Great reason, by the way, something I never considered. As to your question as to why we're not talking about these great victories and all this other meat, you know, it seems like the meal being served for thousands of years has been kind of light, but it's like a real hearty meal, some really brisket on the table. Perhaps we should have. Number one. And number two...
Wait, what did you say? What are you saying about the brisket?
Perhaps we should have been teaching everyone our ancestors about this holiday in more depth. And the second thing was, traditionally, we haven't been celebrating Hanukkah, I think, for more than 100 years.
What do you mean?
Like commercially?
Commercially, yeah, because we live in America. Yeah, but we've been keeping Hanukkah over 2000. You know, it says here since the next year after this event.
But you know, it wasn't like a big deal. Was it even a big deal for you right now?
Yeah.
It was?
Yeah. It was always a big deal. It just became commercialized in America. That's all. Presents and gifts, that all came from Christmas. I'm going to come to Christmas in a few moments. One other suggestion.
I don't know, but like, maybe it ties in the fact that like the rabbis knew, look, we probably fought thousands of battles and tons of wars.
Right.
We won some, we lost some, we fought it to get Israel, right?
Right.
We defeated the tribe. So just another battle, some we win, some we lose. So
we're
not going to really focus in on it.
I'll tell you, we didn't win a lot of battles, you know that. Now, in biblical times we did, but post-biblical times, certainly in the last 2,000 years, what's your association with Jewish history? Persecution, oppression, Holocaust. So, you know, that's why this is a very good question, because it's like, you think we would really want to talk about, like, a few times. Now, I want to give you an answer I heard, which I really, this is the point I was trying to make. Okay, this is the take-home point for tonight, what I wanted to share with you. And that is, what would have happened if the rabbis did get specific, and you all grew up learning, all of us grew up learning about all these military victories, and you became like, you know, like you really studied about them, and it became like a big part of your Jewish curriculum. You're a proud Jew, and you know, we kicked their butt here, we kicked their butt here, they tried to get us here, and we smacked them over there, and we hit them over here. So it's the ego. We also... I think, misunderstand the point of the holiday. Why were we fighting the Greeks? And this is very different than Purim. Purim and Hanukkah are actually really different. Because what does Purim celebrate as opposed to Hanukkah? What was really at stake at Hanukkah? Were they trying to kill Jews?
Yes.
Hanukkah.
No.
Judaism. Think about it for a minute. If the Jews had simply assimilated quietly into the surrounding Hellenistic culture, would there have been any battle at all? No. In fact, Antiochus was not interested in killing Jews. He was interested in killing Judaism. He didn't really care about or interested. He was interested in spreading Hellenism. Purim is just the opposite. Haman was more like a Hitler. Hitler didn't distinguish between religious, not religious, trying to do... He wanted Jews dead. That was Haman. Haman wanted to destroy, physically annihilate Jews. So my theory, I'll take your question in a minute. This is my theory. My theory is the rabbis purposely left out all the details, because if we had too many details about the military victory, we would misunderstand what this whole holiday is about. The Jewish people were not threatened. Judaism was threatened. The only reason why Jews got physically threatened and there were battles is because some of the Jews said, no, I'm not giving up my Judaism. If they did give up the Jews, there wouldn't have been any bloodshed at all. There wouldn't have been a battle. So this is really not about the battles. It's really about the menorah. It's actually about the light of Torah and Judaism. Because had we allowed the light of Judaism to be extinguished, there wouldn't have been any battle, and everybody would be fine, and a Greek and a Jew would have just hugged and embraced, and everyone would be great, except there'd be no Judaism left. And that's why, and I'll come to your question in a minute, it's, and I don't want to be misunderstood, that's why Hanukkah's proximity to Christmas and the whole popularization of Hanukkah over Purim is so interesting to me. Because if you think about ultimately what Hanukkah is celebrating, what is Hanukkah really celebrating? It's celebrating the ability of the Jewish people to remain a minority in a majority culture that believes in something else and not lose ourselves Jewishly. And the irony of ironies is that what made this holiday so popular is because we become so sucked into our American society that we feel we need to do something to keep up with the great festival of Christmas. And I just think how that's just so ironic and interesting. And I'm not, you know, I happen to love, they just put like nice little lights on my building, you know, when you come off the thing. And I was just, my Jill and my wife and I were just walking. She's like, I love this time of year. I do. It's pretty. It's nice. People are friendlier. The traffic in Midtown is terrible. But otherwise, it's just like nice. People are just nicer to each other. And the candles, the lights. And it really is lovely. But along with that lovely is a very subtle kind of... I mean, there's one difference between American society and and God bless this great country and the liberties that we have that we so take for granted in this country. Because no one is putting a gun to head. No one, there's no Antiochus here. Antiochus really wanted to impose Hellenism on Jews. That's not what the United States of America is trying to do. We are guaranteed by our Constitution the right to freely practice whatever religion we want and to think however we choose to think and believe and behave. But there is the, what, a great quote, I want to read this with you. Herman Woke calls the tyranny of the majority, or what we would probably call peer pressure, where we just kind of want to conform and we want to be part of the larger society, that somehow we get swept into this. And I want to dwell on that for a few minutes and conclude with that. But you had a question. That's very good. That's another important distinction. I'm sorry, I know I asked your name before.
Shana
is making an important distinction. God's hand was much more overt and obvious in the Hanukkah story, in a sense, because of these wars and these battles. Purim, you look at the whole Purim story, God's name is never mentioned anywhere in the whole Megillah, and that bespeaks the whole idea of it being a very human kind of thing. It's not a terribly biblical book, you know, where God is so obvious. Hanukkah's God is a little more obvious. So has anyone heard of Herman Woke? Okay, he's 102 years old. You should live
well.
He
just died recently.
Oh, he just passed. He died last year? Okay, I'm sorry. I do remember that now. So he wrote a great book. I have it in the... it's called This Is My God. You should know that he wrote this book here on the Upper West Side, and he used to pray here at the Jewish Center a long time ago, when he was in his 20s. He was already a playwright. He wrote a couple of really wonderful books, Marjorie, Morning Star, The Cain Mutiny, a really accomplished author who became what's called a Baal Tshuva when he was in his 20s. He started gravitating towards religious Judaism. In fact, the rabbi of the Jewish Center, which is the building you're in now, his name was Rabbi Leo Young. He was my dad's professor of philosophy in the 1950s at Yeshiva University. And Herman Woke stepped into the synagogue and became very enamored with Leo Young. And they used to take these walks around the reservoir, right here on 86th Street. This is a long time ago. It's built, this shul's synagogue is over 100 years old. And he convinced him to write this book that we're quoting from now. It's called This Is My God. Follow with me. In over 1,000 years of national existence, and on the soil of Palestine, the Jews over and over drove out oppressors and regained independence. But the Maccabean War, battle for religious liberty alone, found a place in the rites of our faith. It stood out. It was the Jews' first full-scale encounter with the question that was to haunt them for the next 2,000 years, which is, and this is what I would underline, can a small people dwelling in a triumphant major culture take part in the general life and yet hold on to its identity? Or must it be absorbed into the ranks and the ways of the majority. In the two great worlds of current affairs, and he wrote this, I think, in the 50s, so he says the two worlds of current affairs, the communist empire, which so resembles an ancient military dictatorship, and the tolerant, skeptical, free West, they face the question again. I'm going to skip over the Soviet question because it's no longer relevant today for American Jews. Take a look at the last paragraph. The challenge of the West is different, though just as serious. The proposition is the old one, that the Jews are confronted with a better way of life and should give up their religion for it. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth the human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. I want to read that again. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth the human impulse to fight them. When no one is coercing you to do something else, you don't feel the need to... I'm sorry. Oh, that was not your foot cut. You don't feel the need to fight them. You understand? And indeed, and then urge Jews along this path. The position of the government, and indeed the deep conviction of most American leaders, is that the Jewish community has the right to hold fast to the faith of its fathers, and ought to do so. What contradicts them, let's turn the page, is the tidal force that D. Tuchavelli long ago marked as the great weakness of a democracy in his unforgettable phrase, the tyranny of the majority. What's the tyranny of the majority? The pressure to emulate neighbors, the urge to conform to popular views and manners, the deep fear of being different. These in the United States are the forces of Antiochus. Where the power of the sword long ago failed, the power of suggestion has recently been doing rather better. I told you this, by the way, this whole book he writes like this. It's such a powerful book. It would be pleasant to believe... Now he gets back to what I just touched on before. It would be pleasant to believe that the stabbing relevance of Hanukkah to Jewish life in America has occasioned the swell of interest in the holiday. But a different and perfectly obvious cause is at work. By a total accident of timing, this minor Hebrew celebration falls close in the calendar year to a great holy day of the Christian faith. This coincidence has all but created a new Hanukkah. It was entirely natural for a new generation, new Jewish generation growing up in the United States, to feel each December like children in the dark outside a house where there was a gay party. He used the word gay like happy. Okay, pressing their noses wistfully against the windows. That Judaism had its own rich and varied occasions of gaiety was beside the point. Most second-generation Jews were poorly trained in their own faith. And anyway, the Christians had a brilliant midwinter feast, and the Jews did not. Some families solved the problem. You see the problem? You live in the 1950s, you raise your kids, wherever in this country, and everybody's having a... All right, and you're some Jewish kid going to public school, and maybe I have a couple of other friends that are Jewish. Most of your friends are not. And they're all really enjoying Christmas. They're all having a great time. And you're not terribly knowledgeable. You're not terribly learned. You're not terribly committed. This is the typical American Jew in the 1950s. And you don't want your kid to feel like a loser, like on the outside. So there are different ways of solving the problem. Some families introduce Christmas trees. Right, indeed, there are a lot of Jewish families that still have Christmas trees in their homes. And when you ask them, why do you have a Christmas tree? They don't know. Their parents had a Christmas tree and their parents had a Christmas tree. This is one of the reasons why Jews brought in a Christmas tree. Christmas presents, Christmas carols. Which is funny because most of the Christmas carols are made by Jews also. They argued that it was harmful for their children to feel underprivileged. And that the Christmas tree was a mere pleasant ornament of the season without religious content. Meantime, in schools, where there were large numbers of Jewish children, a dual celebration of Christmas and Hanukkah sprang up, an official symbol of mutual courtesy and tolerance. This, in turn, generated a new Jewish interest in Hanukkah. He's giving a little history. How did Hanukkah become so popular amongst American Jews? Even those Jews who were celebrating Christmas in their homes, free holly, born as the King of Israel and all, these are Christmas songs, began to find it seemly to add an electric menorah to their windows, and perhaps even to light the candles. This apparently solved the problem by giving the children the best of both worlds. The aggrandizement of Hanukkah itself is a fortunate accident. The level of knowledge of all of Judaism must rise when any part of it happens, for whatever reason, to gain attention. the son of my skeptical friend is not likely to stop after learning about Hanukkah. So he's saying, you know, it's not bad. We'll take it. Who cares how Hanukkah got more popular? It got more popular. I'm happy about that. It's a Jewish holiday. More Jews are celebrating it. A lack of clear and satisfying religious identity, though, hurts American Jews most in December. This is why the apparently trifling issue of the Christmas tree generates such obduracy and such resentment. It rasps an exposed nerve. It's a good thing that Hanukkah is then at hand, because if the old custom of Hanukkah money, you know, Hanukkah geld, has become the new custom of Hanukkah gifts, right? That came from Christmas. That's a minor shift in manners. The tale of the Feast of Lights, with its all-too-sharp comment on our life nowadays, is very colorful. It is of the greatest use in giving the young a quick grasp of the Jewish historic situation. The gifts win their attention. The little candles stimulate their questions. The observance seems tooled to the needs of self-discovery. Our whole history is a fantastic legend of a single day's supply of oil lasting 8 days. A flaming bush that is not consumed. Of a national life that in the logic of events should have flickered and gone out long ago, but is still burning on. That is the tale we tell our children in the long nights of December when we kindle the little lights while the great Christian feast blazes around us with its jeweled trees and familiar music. The two festivals have one real point of contact. Had Antiochus succeeded in obliterating Jewry a century and a half before the birth of Jesus, there would have been no Christmas. The feast of the Nativity rests on the victory of Hanukkah. It's powerful. He says something very unbelievable. He says they have one point of contact. Had Antiochus been successful, had the Maccabees never revolted against the Greeks, right, which was at least 150 years before Jesus was ever even born, there wouldn't have been no Christmas. The Feast of the Nativity, he says, rests on the victory of Hanukkah. And I think this is such a powerful lesson about Jewish pride and understanding who we are. Because we often feel like, and maybe we don't feel like it so much anymore in 2019, but he wrote this in the 1950s where Jews felt like a little, like a, I don't know, sort of the adopted child, you know, not really fully accepted, if you will, in this society. But we have to remember that Christianity, as magnificent as it is, only came about because of Judaism. And Judaism is only here because they were Jews who said, enough. We are going to stand up for our religion. They weren't standing up for their lives. If they only cared about their lives, there wouldn't have been a battle. Remember that when you light the menorah on two Sunday nights. When you get ready for Hanukkah, remember what you're celebrating. We're not celebrating they tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. That's what we think every Jewish holiday is. It's not true. They didn't try to kill us. They tried to kill our Judaism and our Torah. And because we wouldn't let them do that, then they tried to kill us. But us physically was only incidental to the real threat, which was Jewish continuity, Jewish identity, and our Jewish heritage, the Torah. That's what we're celebrating, and that's why we celebrate Hanukkah, not in a physical way, like Purim, where Haman was trying to kill us physically. How do we celebrate Purim? We sit down to a big festive meal, we drink, we do all these very hearty physical things. Hanukkah, very simple, very modest, very spiritual. We light a menorah. Because the light of the menorah represents the light of Torah, the light of Judaism, what we're trying to bring to the rest of the world. That's what was threatened. That's what we defended. And ultimately, that's what we're celebrating to this day. And if we have a little Christmas to help us out, to popularize the holiday a little more, so be it. But just don't forget that if it wasn't for Judaism, there wouldn't be any Christmas. There wouldn't be any of this. And the Jewish religion and everything we brought to the world would have been extinguished. We would have been fine. But by the way, there wouldn't have been any more Jews anymore today either. Yeah.
Even in the last sermon, it's really funny that most Christmas trees in the city are decorated with blue and silver.
You think they're doing it to celebrate Israel?
No, for Hanukkah.
They're red and green, or whatever they are. But like they make it purposely blue and silver, like in most.
That's funny.
Like,
that's because.
It's because
they want to make the Jews. Jesus was Jewish. I remember when they when I moved into my building, they wanted to know if I was offended at all to have a Christmas tree in my lobby, and I said, not at all. I said, this is, people should practice their religion freely and be proud of it. You know, it would be nice to have a menorah, you know, during the 8 days of Hanukkah.
Same size?
I don't care. I honestly don't care, as long as you can see when you walk in. Yeah, I knew someone was going to make that joke. So, but you know what they did? They put a reef. And I was actually against the reef. The reef is like this neutral. It's like what you put down in a grave. It's like a reef, you know. Like a memorial day, they have the reefs. I don't know, they don't want to offend anyone, you know. Whatever. I'm a big believer in that, you know, we're very, very privileged to live in a country where you could, you have to wear your religion on your sleeve, but you can put your thing outside and not, you know, feel like, you know, the Cossacks are going to come beat us up, you know. So I think it's a nice thing, as long as, you know, we can express ourselves as well. Yeah.
Very important question. The office manager at my company showed me in the electronic.
Yes.
Every single Hanukkah, you can lighten up the light.
You can. You won't fulfill the mitzvah, but you can do that. So technically, in order to fulfill technically the mitzvah, it's supposed to be a candle, actually, either with wax or with oil. It's preferable with oil, but you can use wax. You can just get the wax candle. I think it's nice to have, you know, in the banks and in the hospitals and public places. They're not going to put like a candle. It's going to have to keep. It can be like. Going to start more anti-Semitism if they have to keep rekindling those flames. So they use it there, but you don't technically fulfill the mitzvah, which is every night to light the menorah.
Right.
Let's go through it quickly, by the way. How do you light? Maybe we'll do this a little more next week. I'm teaching a second class on Hanukkah next week, some other material which I didn't share tonight. And we'll talk a little about the actual menorah. But the first night we light one candle, the second night we light two candles, and so on and so forth throughout the 8 nights. But it's easier with the electric, obviously, but it's not technically fulfilling the mitzvah. Yeah?
So I remember learning that in the Messianic era, we're only going to observe Purim and Hanukkah. So assuming that's correct...
I heard just Purim.
Just Purim?
Yeah, the source is... It's a Midrash, it says Purim.
So why only Purim then, when you have all the... quintessential holidays. Why is that going away? So it's too heavy for now. It's okay.
So it's heavy. It's going to be heavy. It has to do, I think, with the Jewish people's reaccepting the Torah into their lives towards the end of the Megillah story. It says at the end of the Megillah, Kimu v'kiblu, that they accepted, and it's a little vague what they reaccepted, and the Talmud says they reaccepted the Torah because you alluded to this. They received the Torah at Sinai, where God's hand was very obvious, but the Purim story, God's hand was not obvious, and now they were finally in a place where they could see God, even when He wasn't in their face. And that is something that hopefully is connected to the Messianic era.
So just Purim, we're scrapping Pesach. And
we're not scrapping anything, we're just living in a time where those holidays are not as necessary.
You can't take the matzah.
You can't bring the matzah with you. I'm sorry. You can eat matzah, but there's a big debate as to what happens in the Messianic age. Maybe we'll teach a class about the Mashiach. Yeah? Because there's a big debate as to whether you even have a body and will consume things physically at all in the Messianic age. Yes, any other questions or comments? Hanukkah questions? Maccabees? Latkes?
I have a question for you. The menorah has 8.
Yes.
Nine?
Eight. It has eight, and it has the thing in the middle. What's the dude in the middle called? The shamash.
So what's a Hanukkiah?
Hanukkiah is a menorah for Hanukkah.
So how come some menorahs only have like 6 or 7? That's not really a menorah.
Correct. You got gypped.
The manufacturer.
It's just like a nice budget cuts. What's that? Yeah, the menorah in the temple is not the Hanukkiah.
Funny story, so I bought this stove, I thought was menorah last year, it was really
Where'd you buy it?
I forgot.
Right, okay. You got taken. All right, listen, it happens. There are worse things. Why do we... Oh, yeah, question, Maya. Okay, so thank you. Okay, we're going to get rid of one thing. I can't stand the whole Hanukkah thing. What defines you as a Jew is your ability to cha. If you cha, you're Jew. So let's do it. Guys, happy Hanukkah. Okay, great. One other thing. Why do we have latkes? What's the idea behind it? They taste delicious.
Oil.
I mean, oil. Okay, it's just oily foods, that's all. Right. So that's why, yeah, oily. It's, and it doesn't have to be... What's that? That's why we had pizza tonight. That was Maya's thinking. And donuts.
The Sephardi ate donuts, that's for the same reason, because of the oil, right?
The Sephardi eat donuts?
The Sephardi use donuts to celebrate Hanukkah, right?
I have no idea. Do you?
Yeah, but so do Ashkenazim.
I think Ashkenazim also. My mother used to make, because of oil.
Yeah.
Why are you projecting this onto the Sephardi community? They do have better food, let's face it. Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind. All right, there's some more oily food. What's that? Bacha?
What about the N's and the K's and the H? There's a lot more letters than that.
Oh, Chanukah. So I'll talk about that next week.
Okay.
There, in the word Chanukah is actually the miracle. Because it says Chanukah. Kafe is 25th of the Kislev. They rested. They stopped fighting. But I will talk a little more about that stuff next week.
I just want to quickly